From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the head of the Massachusetts State Police is retiring 2 years after taking over the scandal-plagued agency. Governor Baker is speaking with the press this hour, and we'll bring you the latest. Also today, it was an exciting election night in Massachusetts. Some big wins, some close finishes, a few upsets, and at least one recount. We'll break down the results from across the region. And actor Justin Long. His new film is opening the Boston Jewish Film Festival. It's about safe spaces on college campuses.
She brought an incident to me where she felt unsafe in your classroom last week.
Like, I don't know what this is about, but I can tell you that I feel kind of unsafe in my class most days.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we're waiting word from Governor Charlie Baker, who is set to speak with members of the media this hour. That's after the announcement earlier today that Colonel Kerry Gilpin, the head of the troubled state police, is retiring. Our reporter Steve Brown is there. We will get the latest from him later in the hour. But in the meantime, we have a lot of news to digest from yesterday's local elections. I want to get started there. Joining me now from the Boston Globe is Deputy City Editor Mike Bellow. Mike, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So, Mike, a lot to take in, especially here in Boston. But I want to start with the big picture. What races across the state were you following most closely, and how are you thinking about them today?
Well, there are a lot of mayoral races. You had voters in 58 communities across the state go to the polls electing a lot of mayors, some interesting figures. You know, you had in Brockton, changing of the guard, obviously the mayor there, Bill Carpenter, had passed away. Robert Sullivan defeated Jimmy Pereira. Taunton got its first female mayor, Shauna O'Connell. She's a Republican who defeated city councilor Estelle Borges. There was a battle in Melrose. You had your Democratic state rep Paul Brodeur defeating councilor at large Medeiros. So pretty interesting stuff. Also, the changing of the guard did not take place in a number of communities. You had Mayor Joseph Curtatone in Somerville defeating a first-time candidate. Waltham's veteran mayor Jeanette McCarthy held her own. And in Worcester, incumbent Joseph M. Petty has now set a record, I think, for being mayor elected to a fifth two-year term. So in some places it was the changing of the guard. In other words, the incumbent survived, but certainly an interesting thing.
Yeah, so Mike, that's a big landscape. Some changes, some staying the same, some new faces, some familiar faces. Is there any kind of clear picture that emerges for you about what's happening in the Commonwealth, or is it kind of a hodgepodge depending on the locality?
I think it depends on the locality. I think a lot of the cities, you know, people are very concerned about money, very concerned about property taxes, maintaining infrastructure. You know, in some places they were building new police headquarters or trying to maintain roads. And I think, you know, people really were forced to talk about jobs, public schools, transportation, you know, issues affecting voters' daily lives. And I think, you know, people were seeking to trust the person who promised that they could deliver on those things and make life better for anyone living in those particular communities.
Mike, let's talk about Boston. It looks like women and people of color are going to make up a majority of the Boston City Council for the first time in the city's history. How big of a deal is that? Put that in context.
Well, it's really an amazing transformation. You know, you got City Councilor Michelle Wu. She coasted to victory. I think she got something like 21% of the vote, putting her ahead of fellow incumbents Anissa George and Michael Flaherty. But now, starting in January, you're going to have a council that will have 8 women on it and 7 councilors of color. That's the most ever. And that changes the identity of a panel that was historically dominated by white guys. Until fairly recently. So it's very interesting. You know, you know, where a majority of the residents of the city are black, Latino, Asian, you know, biracial. So it's a resounding call from residents who, you know, want transformational change, according to people we talk to. And I think a lot of these campaigns focused on issues that affect a lot of people, you know, housing, transportation, the environment. They had a turnout of, I think, 16.5%. That was around 3% more than the last council race 2 years ago. But there was a lot of people who got elected, and, you know, a lot of incumbents were leaving. So a real transformation on the council. And in terms of, you know, a lot of people were talking about the so-called Ayanna Presley effect. You know, Presley's election to Congress showed a council seat can serve as a launching pad to greater community activism, higher office. And I think a lot of the people who ran have a lot of political ambition to do some great things. There is one of the council races, by the way, which is very close, only separated by 10 votes. And that's the race where Julia Mejia and Alexandra St. Guillen, you know, are battling, and Guillen is obviously, St. Guillen has asked for a recount, so
how's
that's
that
going down
work?
To the wire.
Mike, is there precedent for that? Do we know how a recount like that works, or are we going to just have to figure it out as we go along?
I think, well, the Secretary of State, you know, is obviously going to take a look at it. They'll eventually impound the ballots, and they'll count them. And that'll, you know, it's going to take a while. You know, there's no particular timetable, obviously, but, you know, it could be a couple of weeks. Or more until they look at all the ballots, where the any discrepancies, absentee ballots. But certainly the Secretary of State's office will be involved along with the City Election Department.
All right. What are you going to watch for going forward, Mike?
Well, I think, you know, there is a real sense of change and people, you know, grassroots movements, you know, people in the neighborhood, certainly in the city of Boston, trying to have more of a say. You know, Mayor Walsh has run the city. He's in his second term. Obviously, in a couple of years, he'll run for a third term. And you look in this city council race, Michelle Wu kind of emerges as a potential challenger. There's also City Council President Campbell, Andrea Campbell. She could also be a challenger. So, you know, he is, I think there are a lot of people who represent people in the neighborhoods, people of color, Hispanic folks, others who want to say in city government. And so I think the mayor is going to have to pay more attention to the neighborhoods in this city. Not that he hasn't already, but really, given the election results, it certainly speaks that other things are happening that he has to pay attention to.
So it sounds like in a lot of ways, the elections across the state are about what's coming next, whether it's greater sense of power and ability to challenge into other seats in the Boston City Council or the bread and butter issues that people around the Commonwealth are feeling pretty urgently need to get addressed in the next couple of years. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, I also think there's a question of, you know, aid to cities and towns, funding of the schools, you know, that big education thing up at the State House. You know, that's what really matters to people is, you know, the taxes they're paying, where's the money going, you know, will their communities remain growing and prosperous and trying to get investment in urban communities where people need more money to make things better.
That's Mike Bellow, Boston Globe Deputy City Editor. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So here to further break down the elections is Marie St. Fleur. She's a former Massachusetts state representative and principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
We're also joined by Seti Warren, the former mayor of Newton, an Iraq war veteran, and currently executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Seti, welcome back.
Great to be here.
And you. We'd like you to join the conversation. What happened in your community yesterday? How do you feel about your local election results? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to pull up a chair and join the conversation. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, Marie Seti, I want to start with Boston. We just discussed the recount that's been requested in the city council there. First-time candidate Julia Mejia has a 10-vote lead over fellow Latina newcomer Alejandra St. Guillen. We're going to keep reporting on that as it goes, but as you also heard, in the meantime, three at-large councilors reelected, Michelle Wu, Anissa Saibi-George, Michael Flaherty. What are your reactions to how Boston went down yesterday? Marie, I'll start with you.
I think it's, as has been mentioned before, it is a real change. For me, it's energized our democracy. I mean, that's what happened yesterday. If you think of Boston being a majority minority city, and it's been that, I think, for close to 10 years, if not more. And finally, the city council is governance body is reflecting the diversity that exists in Boston. So I think that is pretty amazing. Because you had such an active playing field, right? Can number of candidates. You also energize every sector of the city that normally would have been asleep during a city council race. And so I think you brought new people to the polls who otherwise would not have gone to the polls normally. So I think that, again, the diversity of the candidates forced every neighborhood to be involved in this race this year. And I think that's why we've seen the bump up. And I saw also the national debate. The national debate, I think, is encouraging people to understand that democracy is us. If we want it, then we have to be involved in it. If we want it to reflect us, then we have to do the work to get it. I'm excited for the women who are about to lead.
So, Seti, what are the lasting benefits in a community of this kind of injection of enthusiasm and engagement and urgency that Marie is talking about?
Well, first of all, I think it's quite remarkable. As someone who grew up in this region, remembering the Mel King race, remember that?
I do.
it is extraordinary that we have this body made up of women and people of color. So I just want to, I don't want us to lose that piece
of it.
Well,
it happened fast. I mean, Ayanna Pressley was the first black member of the city council not that long ago.
Yes. And the other thing I think this speaks to is the great inequality that's growing, the inequity between people of color and whites here in this region. The Boston Globe did that terrific series over a year ago that outlined the huge inequities, inequality, and lack of economic mobility. In addition to the identity of the candidates, it's also what they're supporting, what they want to see happen. Affordable housing, educational opportunities for everyone, accessible transportation. So I don't want to lose the policy points that they were making. And I spent a lot of time in a number of neighborhoods when I was running statewide and heard the same stories of barriers to transportation, barriers to housing, the gentrification challenges in Boston. So I think that's also it's a wake-up call for the region that we've got to – people want these issues addressed, and there's an urgent need to deal with them.
Marie, I want to stay with the sort of the breadth of change conversation for a little bit longer, because I also want to note that in District 5, which includes parts of Roslindale, Hyde Park, Mattapan, Ricardo Arroyo became the first Latino to take the seat. That was Tom Menino's seat.
That's correct.
I mean, again,
as
that
Hyde
is
Park.
Sweeping yeah. change in a relatively short, yeah. relatively short period of time.
So I actually pushed back on the idea that it's been that it's been short time.
Doesn't feel fast
no,
to you.
No, because for so many
that's
of us,
point.
It's been a long
wait
time.
A minute. That's a great point. That's a great point.
I'm just saying, you know, and I think I remember Hyde Park. I remember some of the first families who moved into Hyde Park to desegregate Hyde Park. I was a kid at the time during the whole busing era. And to see that today, that a person of color is actually elected out of that neighborhood, I think is exciting. The fact that you had a woman, because for many years that seat was actually an Irish male seat until Menino grabbed it. And he had it there for a long time and then went back to the men again. And so that the fact that a woman, you had a woman and a person of color who stood up and were able to garner the votes that they did and were successful, I think that says a lot for the transformation that is happening in Boston. And it took a lot. It took people really doing the voting piece, really getting people, registered. It took educating people. It took the community-based organizations who continued to talk at the grassroots level to encourage people to participate. And I think it took all of that. And it took training people. Some of these folks who are now today, they were involved in some training program that said that it's time for you to be involved, whether it was the Commonwealth Institute or Emerge or somebody that got people involved. So there's been a lot of groundwork being done in order to make certain that we can diversify this council that we have today.
So, Seti, is Marie reframing correctly, which is it's less, wow, that was fast, and more, well, it's about time.
I remember as a child, my father was Assistant Secretary of Education for Michael Dukakis and specifically worked on desegregating the Boston schools. This was not that long ago where my parents did not want me to go anywhere near South Boston or Charlestown as a child because of what was happening. So to your point, that was not that long ago.
No, it wasn't.
And there are a lot of people involved with laying the groundwork, including you, Marie.
Thank you.
So I think I would agree with what Marie mentioned.
There is one other big – I'm going to take a call in a minute, but there is one other big change I wanted to note, which is that physical therapist Liz Breeden, who won in District 9, which covers Alston and Brighton, she's also a first – she's the first openly gay woman to serve on the Boston City Council, according to the LGBTQ Victory Fund. She beat out a former state legislative aide with long ties to the community. It does feel like the Boston City Council is a place for everyone. And a place that's attracting a lot of talent because it is not a dead end.
That's right.
And I think there might have been a time when it was kind of a dead end, Marie. What do you think?
Well, I think that, Tommy Menino showed that it actually not, because he went from there and became the mayor of the city of Boston. And there are others who've been able to take the leap. But I think in our time, the most visible has been Ayanna Pressley, who's been able to take it and moved on to Congress. But at the end of the day, the other thing that's happened is people are saying, this is my government and I want a part and a say in it. And I'm willing to go and knock on the doors and talk to the people and tell them what it is that I can do for them. The other thing that's happening is they're talking in the current people's language, right? Because there's some things that have been happening in those neighborhoods that we've talked about. There's been progress, but the people who are actually living there are saying, well, I actually am not feeling the progress. I'm not feeling the progress in that I can't afford a place to live. I'm not feeling the progress because I'm not certain about the education of my children. I'm not feeling the progress because I still hear gunshots out in my neighborhood. I'm not feeling the progress. So they're looking for somebody who's actually talking in that language and saying, okay, I hear you. The systems that are in place and the mechanisms for driving the changes you want to see in your neighborhood are not working quite the way we want to. We want to offer another vision and another way to get there. And people are buying that.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Let's grab a call. Rose from Everett, pull up a seat at the table. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just want to give a huge shout out to Girlie Adrian, the first Haitian American woman to sit in city council. And I'm very proud. There was a lot of grassroots efforts that went into that. And I'm just very proud with the turnout Massachusetts is showing. I think now there's more of a representation of what the city of Boston actually looks like versus how it was before.
What does it mean for you, Rose? What does it mean to you personally?
So personally, for me, like for the longest time, like I don't know, although I live in the city, I just feel sometimes that, you know, in certain spaces and different places you go, that the representation is not there. Also, like with job mobility, it's hard. Like, you know, just going, you know, even though like, you know, at least a few of my friends, you know, we can have like bachelor's degrees and master's degrees, and it's just hard to get a job in the city.
All right, we'll take it from you from there, Rose. Not only do I appreciate your call and building on what we were just talking about, you're really giving voice to some of what, especially I think Marie and Seti were saying, but it does give me a chance to raise another set of issues that came up in some local elections. So I appreciate that. And I'm going to turn to Seti to start this one, because I want to talk about city council elections in Newton for a second. Seti, not only because you used to be the mayor there, but they were interesting because there felt like there was a real battle in Newton about development and about affordable housing. How did that shake out?
So when I was mayor in my second term, I remember pushing support for two pretty substantive mixed-use housing projects, one on Austin Street, one on Washington Street. There were groups that were organized to try to stop those projects, and they squeaked by the city council, and I laud the council for supporting them, and I was out in front. Today, or last night, what you saw, there is real activism on the pro-development side that had not been at Newton several years ago. So that's one thing that is noticeable. The second piece is, I think what we saw was a reflection of what's happening in Newton in the greater Boston region. The need for affordable units, the need for additional units to be built, the cost of renting, the cost of buying has just gone up in an extreme way in Newton, but then also in the greater Boston area. the need to create additional units. So I think you also saw that in the reflecting last night's election, where, you know, there are a number of folks, pro-development folks, that won, got reelected, and there are some pro-development folks that lost.
So is there a path forward there? Or are we looking at gridlock because both interests gained ground?
Right. So in my view, and I think, by the way, Newton is not alone, right? There are other communities that are having this conversation. One, we need to talk about housing holistically. In other words, not just the housing project itself, but include transportation, include where people are working. Right, we can't separate these things. They've got to be combined. Second, we've got to make sure when we talk about these projects, and I did this in Newton, we have to be forward-looking, identify areas where development can happen, should happen. Municipalities should be doing this ahead of time, not just allowing the market or developer to drive the process. There are benefits to doing that because you can show your residents, your people, that certain mixed-use development can actually help the economics of the city center. My project on Austin Street is an example of that. Third thing is that we have to take a regional approach. I know that there are several mayors that have come together recently in the greater Boston area and make commitments on housing, but we really need to have regional plans that include transportation, housing, where people work. As you and you both know, every region in the state is different. Right, the needs of Central Mass and Western Mass in regard to transportation and housing and jobs are very different than Greater Boston, the Cape, and the North Shore. So those are three things that I think need to happen in order to advance the conversation.
So Marie Setti's his emphasis on sort of regional solutions for problems that acutely affect people in any given municipality. Mm-hmm. That's on my mind very much. You know, you had how things shook out in housing in Newton. Mm-hmm. You also had Cambridge. The community went through a fierce fight over a proposed affordable housing overlay. Mm-hmm. It was tabled, but it had echoes in its city council. Six of the nine newly elected councilors there supported that mm-hmm. idea. How sooner or later these municipalities are going to have to come to the same table and develop the same agenda that is going to solve some of our regional transportation, housing. How does that happen?
It has to happen. And I think that one of the things that I appreciate, and I agree with what Setti has to say. I mean, as a former state rep and representing the 5th Suffolk District, my feeling was always the idea was everybody should just end up in Boston because it had the infrastructure. And as long as they disappeared into Boston, we didn't have to worry about what happened otherwise. And so the other surrounding communities could pretend that they don't have people who clean their homes, have people who have dry cleaners, have people who work in their small local stores, people who work in their restaurants. Those people need a place to stay too. And they need an affordable place to stay. And some of the wages that they're earning even in those communities are not enough to help them live in the communities where they work. And so therefore, I think all of us need to understand and take responsibility for everybody who makes up our community and support our community. So the guy who pumps the gas at your local gas store, he needs a place to stay too, and it needs to be affordable. And so as long as they could come from someplace else and go do those jobs and go back home, it was fine. I think that what we're finding is Boston's does not even have enough infrastructure to absorb, if you ever take a walk around, the people that are coming in or the community that currently exists. And so it's not a not in my backyard piece. It's a we're all in this together piece, and that we need to have a regional approach to housing. And we also, with housing, is going to have to come how we think about wages, paying people a living wage. Stop nickel and diming people with these whether it's Department of Transitional Assistance, we'll have some real solutions that are going to get to people. People are not looking to get a handout. They want some help and assistance to work, but we've reduced them to always trying to figure out how to connect benefits together in order to live. And so until we take care of how we provide them the opportunity to access a living wage that makes sense for them to pay for where they live, we're going to continue to have that problem. We also have to build more housing, and we actually have to talk to people about what we mean by affordable housing. Because affordable to me, affordable to my kid who just got out of college, affordable to the person that's working in the daycare center.
Or the older adult.
Or the older adult. So who are we talking about? So in Boston in particular, so the regional approach is critical. I think we need government leadership at the corner office and the governor's office, and we need the leadership and all the regional, the mayors, the city councils. We need them to take leadership and say, these are Massachusetts residents. They all need a place to stay, and we're going to figure out how to make that
okay,
work.
Okay, so I want to use that chance to compare and contrast, because we've been talking a lot about this new Boston City Council, the new face of the Boston City Council. It's a very progressive Boston City Council compared to previous councils. On the other hand, you have an election like the one in Taunton yesterday, where they have their first woman mayor, both candidates on both political parties, although it's not a partied position, mm-hmm. but both the progressive and the conservative were women. Taunton picked Shauna O'Connell, who is a state rep with a long and strong reputation as both a Republican and a very conservative mm-hmm. state rep. So we see two communities in Massachusetts going in very different directions. Sadie, do we have a mismatch inside the Commonwealth of what people's priorities are?
Well, obviously we have to acknowledge the regional differences, the makeup of these communities. But I do want to say, being a mayor, I used to say, I'm not the mayor of the Democrats. I'm the mayor of everyone, right? When you hire a chief executive, they want to ensure that you are looking at things through a nonpartisan way. You are going to fix the roads. You're going to make sure there are enough teachers in the classroom. You're going to respond to an emergency in the city. So I do think there's a little bit of a different lens versus a city councilor, where there's more room for activism in some ways. And for a mayor, there's more room for, can you run it? Can you manage it? So I think it's a different lens.
All right, so let's jump out to 30,000 feet for just a minute. Were either of you watching other races around the country? Was there anything of note nationally for you coming out of yesterday?
Well, I'm still waiting on Kentucky.
Yeah, I was about to say Kentucky. Kentucky.
How did I know? Kentucky governor's race,
oh, my
right?
Goodness.
And Virginia turning completely Democrat.
So Virginia turns all Democrat in its state legislature. Right. And in Kentucky, we have a close race between two gubernatorial candidates. The incumbent is Republican in Mitch McConnell's mm-hmm. state. And it appears, although it's close, mm-hmm. that a Democratic challenger has won. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, if you look at Mississippi, I think there's glimmers of hope in Mississippi. I think if you look at the numbers for Hood, and I'm not going to be able to tell them, there's an indication here that there's been an increase in the voting strength of the blue sector. The bottom line is we're all going to have to think about ourselves as Americans, this red and blue thing. I mean, if we look at the data on whether it's obesity, whether some of the challenges that are happening in Mississippi, whoever becomes governor is going to have the new governor is going to have to deal with those issues in order to maintain power. And
okay.
just the same for in Taunton. You've got to deal with others.
I got to stop you there. So Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state rep and principal at St. Fleur Communications. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Seti Warren, former mayor of Newton, Iraq war veteran, and currently executive director of the Shorenstein Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Going to take a quick break. Stay with us. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And Justin Long is in Studio 3 with us. Many of you know him maybe as the charming underdog in Dodgeball or a computer hacker in Live Free or Die Hard, the guy who eventually gets the girl in like a lot of romantic comedies, including He's Just Not That Into You. I happen to know him first as a high schooler in Ed years and years ago.
Yes.
I loved you in that show, by
Aww.
The way. But he's also well known for appearing as the Mac in those famous 2000s Mac versus PC commercials. And today, he's in Boston for the premiere of his new movie, Safe Spaces, which will open the Boston Jewish Film Festival tonight at the Coolidge. So really nothing to talk about, Justin.
No, that's it. So, well, it was nice to see you.
And, I'm going to go.
Take care.
That's all right.
But I have to just say, Tiziana, thank you so much for that introduction, and specifically for not using the word nerd or geek or dork or any derivation thereof when describing some of those characters. That was really impressive. The charming underdog. It's usually some form of he was the nerd in this and the
no,
geek in that.
No, he was a totally charming underdog in Dodgeball.
That's very nice.
That's right. And many of us have watched it, let's say, recently to be reminded of that.
Yeah, so. Oh, that's nice.
All right. So the first question I want to ask you, because it's kind of cool. Do I understand, is it true that you're part-time at least living in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I do. I live in Western Mass. I live in the Berkshires, a little place in a little town, not far from like Stockbridge,
yeah.
Great Barrington.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time there, probably so about half the time.
What drew you there?
When I was a kid, we used to spend a week on this lake, and it was just I had the best memories. And we had to stop going at a certain point, just financial cutbacks, whatever. And I just so missed it. And when I made a little bit of money, I thought, well, there's no better thing to spend it on than a place at this very lake. So we went back up there and found a little spot there.
It was fun to hear you say made a little money because we have a little bit of a running.
I didn't know how to say that without
something. No, that's
like
fine. Because we have a little bit of a running joke here on Radio Boston that it's actually when you reach a certain age that our famous people wind up settling in Massachusetts.
Oh, that's funny, yeah.
But in your case, it was reach a certain level of success before you.
Yes, I needed the money.
Yeah, okay, very
yeah,
good.
So
and what's the transition like? I mean, you my understanding is you really were in that scene, the L.A. and New York kind of scene.
Yeah.
What's the transition like to the quiet, bucolic Western Massachusetts landscape?
Well, it's coincided with my aging, obviously. The time has gone by, and so I've just gotten to a place in my life where that lifestyle in New York, whatever I was experiencing in my 20s was just not as appealing. I literally just don't have the energy for it. So I took up gardening.
You're just too tired.
Yeah, no, I like a slower pace now, and I love to fish and garden and obviously, it's so much easier to do that there than in New York or L.A. And I just like the pace. I like the people up there. And but I still return to the city, and I work in L.A. a lot. So I still can kind of dip my toes in that world.
All right. So you are here in Boston because you've got this new film, Safe Spaces. It's going to open at the Boston Jewish Film Festival tonight. It's directed by Daniel Schechter, and it follows your character, Josh, who is navigating a bunch of things, grandmother's illness, some pretty shallow relationships in his personal life, an incident in his job. He's an adjunct professor at NYU, and a student accuses of him of creating an unsafe space in his classroom. NYU is New York University. I should be clearer. Ultimately, for me, the film was about family, I felt. But it looked like it was also intended to be about, you know, Me Too and safe spaces. So what appealed to you about doing it?
I liked the journey that he was going through. I loved the first thing was the most immediate thing was the story about the grandmother and what he's struggling with in terms of she's dying and they're trying. The family has to come together.
She has cancer.
She has cancer, and I'm very close with my own grandmother and who is shockingly both of them are still alive. They're both 102, which is
that's incredible. Nuts.
Incredible. And so that I and it was so beautifully written. All of that stuff. It was very honest and grounded. My whole family, I come from a family of teachers, and so I've seen versions of, not in terms of like the Me Too climate now and all that, but I've seen versions of like power struggle that they've gone through with students and dynamics within their careers that I thought this might be an interesting way to explore. But the movie, I think, really is about this guy's growth and the need for empathy and the need to listen. And we've had a really positive response to it just from audiences.
I want to play a clip for listeners. This is when Josh is reckoning with the fact that students, including a student who felt his class was not a safe space for her, they're upset. Another student was compelled by Josh to reveal an intimate and uncomfortable sexual experience.
He's a creative writing teacher, and so he tries to draw out some of these experiences that these kids have to use in their writing.
And in this segment, he's finding out that his students were upset about that.
Well, she may never come back to class. And frankly, I don't blame her if this is your attitude.
Guys, I'm feeling very unsupported here. I'm also very confused as to who has the power on this campus.
I know you're new to teaching, and sometimes it's not what you think it's going to be.
Okay, I got an idea. How about I teach two classes a week that I've scheduled and prepared, and the students who show up and do the work get good grades, and those who don't get bad grades.
Your attitude is ridiculous.
I think this whole thing is ridiculous, Terry, frankly. And I'm not new to being a student. I was a student before this, and this is nothing like the college I remember. I was 19. What the hell did I know?
Look, I just really hope you reconsider giving an apology.
Terry, I really don't think I did anything wrong.
Justin, you were kind of animated just now listening to that as I was playing it. What was that about?
Probably just a tick. this guy's taking my photo right here, and I will always have this thing. I don't know. I think it comes from childhood, where one of my least favorite days was school photo day. I felt very self-conscious and insecure, and it's so funny. Every once in a while, I mean, this is 30 years ago, and I still see remnants of that. I chose the wrong profession, I think.
So our listeners don't know that we're entirely surrounded by glass. So
yes,
Justin is able to see.
In a little aquarium.
So I want to bring you
terrarium.
To this. Right. I want to bring, no water.
Sorry. Yeah.
I want to bring you to this clip for a minute. Did Josh do anything wrong? He did press a student in the classroom scene to reveal a very intimate experience. In your mind, did your character do anything wrong?
This is the interesting thing, I think, about the journey that this character goes through, is that it's all about nuance and the need for, like I said, empathy. And I just don't think he was, in that moment, being empathetic enough to somebody else's experience. He has that arc in the movie, I think, and not to give anything away, but that's what I think he comes to – that's the growth that he goes through and comes to understand, is that we have no idea what people's experiences are and where they're coming from. And I think that's a very interesting part of the movie, is being a little bit more sensitive to that. And I think that's what a lot of these movements are about, stepping back a little bit and exercising a little bit more empathy.
You know, as I was watching it, one of the things that kept running through my head, you have been so lovable so many times in the characters that you've played over the years.
What does that mean?
Well,
no, I'm kidding.
I'm like, okay, if you have a problem with that,
well, now,
I'm
wait
not
a minute.
Sure you're going to like what I'm going to say next.
I did
not find Josh lovable.
Oh, good. Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
And I wondered, was it at all as an actor hard or scary for you to play someone not lovable?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's appealing because it is in my nature to I want people to like me. I mean, it's I don't know if it's vanity or ego or maybe something that's slightly more positive, but I do have that in me. It's difficult for me when people don't love me. I was just talking to a friend about this, that they're able to. Who was it? Why was it that they don't need to? I was interviewing. So I've been doing a podcast. I was interviewing this actress, Jamila Jamil, and she
from The Good Place.
From The Good Place, yes. And she's very active on social media and very outspoken. And I said, and she's upset many people by some of the things she says. And I was asking her about that. How just psychologically, how is she able to contend with that? You know, because I if I put something out there and I find that it offends people, it really freaks me out. And I have and she basically said she doesn't. It's for the greater good. I mean, it's a really noble thing. I mean, she's far more noble than I am, and she's very convicted about her beliefs and very passionate. And I thought that was so admirable and fascinating. And I guess that is my long-winded way of saying. As an actor, it was really appealed to me to explore somebody who was less, you know, not very likable, and was doing things that were questionable that I would hope that I wouldn't do.
You know, you mentioned that you're doing a podcast, and I do have a couple questions for you about that. But before we talk about the podcast itself, you did an episode with Jonah Hill last month, and you said that your life really changed when you stopped identifying as an actor.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I think there was I got so much self-worth, so much value based solely on what I did, which for the last several years has been to act in things.
Really since 2000, I think.
Yeah.
Right? 99, 2000.
I mean, I guess 20 years. So half my life.
To be fair.
Yeah. So it became my identity. I mean, that became a focal point of my identity. And so if I didn't get a certain job or if somebody – I started – I think you can get really lost in that if that's how you identify, if you identify solely as your job, especially if it's something as elusive and transitory as acting can be, as a career in acting is. So I've known older actors who had that mindset, who would only describe themselves as actors, and they – seemed quite unhappy. I've known a lot of unhappy
actors.
So that's so interesting. I'm going to play a cut for you in a second here. We sort of joked earlier, you know, you and John Hodgman were in those famous Apple PC commercials. We actually had John Hodgman on recently.
I know.
Did you hear it?
No, I didn't hear it, but your producer had said he was here. And he's from Brookline.
He is. Yeah. And he's back in the area now that he's reached a certain age.
Yes, there
and
you
a certain
go.
Level of financial success. Yeah. But he talked, I wonder if we have time to do here. I'm just going to paraphrase it because I'm not sure we have time for the cut. But he was talking about a book where he's letting go of some of the fame and both missing some of it, but also recognizing it as an opportunity to be less about that fame and more about just being kind of honest and out there and who he is.
Well, I'm sure he said it far more eloquently than I just did. Or
but it
could.
Sounds like it's similar,
similar
to what
very
you're
much
saying.
So. Yeah. I think a lot of people who are in that our profession go through a version of that. And I've seen people go, you know, you can go either direction. And Joan and I were talking about it in the context of him having gone through a worst version of it.
Jonah Hill.
He became so successful and it kind of he lost sight of some of the important things. He tells a very interesting story about checking Rotten Tomatoes scores for a movie that he directed and completely losing sight of the joy of having done the movie. And I've experienced versions of that myself where you get caught up in the trappings of it.
Is that why you do the podcast with your brothers? Because it gives you joy?
That wasn't an overt reason to have done it, but it's become a really nice byproduct of it. It's brought me so much joy. And I was talking to the director of this movie, Safe Spaces, about that, Dan, that it's gives us creative freedom too.
Because you're really in those podcasts just having conversations with people you like about stuff.
It's the best. I mean, the company that we do it with had approached me about doing it, so it wasn't something that I dared to even attempt on my own or had the audacity to think that, I could even do this or people would be interested. But once they did and once we started doing it, I came to
so
find it.
Who have you not had that yet that you wish you could have on your podcast?
Oh, so many people. I mean,
No. You got to pick one.
Well, I love Michael J. Fox. I grew up watching, just idolizing him. And I would love to have him on. We're going to – Alec Baldwin's going to be on soon. I'm trying to think who Jamila was great. We've been really lucky. We've had some, and we've had friends on. John, I hope to have on. John Hodgman's going to, we're going to do.
There you go, John.
Yeah, John, where are you? I think in a couple of weeks we're going to have him on, but it's just been the best. What is that?
This is our end music.
That's for me to say. Oh, this is you're playing me off.
Yes, we are.
Okay,
as a matter
time
of
to
fact,
leave.
But very gently, because you weren't even sure what we were
doing. No, it's like waiting room, nice, relaxing music. I feel like I'm about to get a massage.
So that's actor Justin Long. He's in Boston for the premiere of Safe Spaces, which will open the Boston Jewish Film Festival tonight. It'll show again Thursday and Sunday. It's also going to be released more widely under the title After Class in December. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's so nice.
You can find more information at radioboston.org. We're going to take a break. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts State Police Superintendent Colonel Carrie Gilpin has announced she's retiring. She served as head of the agency for 2 years. Governor Baker just finished speaking to reporters at the State House moments ago.
Colonel Gilpin submitted her retirement letter effective November 15th, and will be leaving the state police at that time. I want to thank her for her 25 years of service to the Commonwealth, and especially for her work as colonel over the course of the past 2 years.
WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown is following the story, joins us now from the State House. Hey there, Steve.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you?
Good, thanks. Steve, you just heard remarks from Governor Baker. What did he have to say?
Well, he said the governor said that Colonel Gilpin started with a small investigation that significantly expanded with respect to reporting and accounting issues at Troop E. That was the troop that used to patrol the Massachusetts Turnpike from the New York border all the way into Boston. And several state troopers there were found to be putting in for shifts that they were getting paid for shifts that they never worked. Based on the results of this report, the governor said, Colonel Gilpin disbanded Troop E and referred 46 of those troopers to the U.S. Attorney's and Massachusetts Attorney General's office for potential prosecution. He said that effort was incredibly effective first step for the state police because the behavior and decisions that were made by the people who were part of that scandal at Troop E tarnished an organization as has many fine people working for it. He says that more work still needs to be done.
So Steve, Gilpin had been in the role for 2 years. She's 49. It feels kind of sudden. Has she said why she's stepping down or why now in particular?
She hasn't really expanded upon that. She doesn't talked to the media at all, as much as I can remember, in the past 2 years that she's been in that position. I've heard from sources that this was a planned retirement. She's got 25 years in, two of those at the top salary, so she's in line for a very good pension. In her statement, she said that the department has accomplished so much during a difficult time. She says she's leaving this job with the satisfaction of knowing that she gave it her heart and soul under the most trying conditions.
What are the reactions, Steve? Are you hearing surprise from people? Are there those saying, I saw this coming? How's it playing out?
Yeah, some of the folks in the legislature that I've spoken with were a bit surprised. Some thought that she wasn't really given a fair shot. It was only 2 years ago that she got the top job. But it was pointed out to me that many of the problems at the agency have been going on for a very long time, almost generational, and that it might take a couple of superintendents to make a complete overhaul over the state police. You know how the old saying goes, a new broom sweeps clean. Well, they might need a few new brooms.
Well, and she was a new broom, Steve, right? I mean, her predecessor, Colonel Richard McKean, and his number two, Francis Hughes, both stepped down in the wake of a scandal. This was the case where a trooper alleged he was instructed by McKean to remove details from an arrest record of a judge's daughter. You have sort of laid out some of what she's tried to accomplish. What is the back and forth between the scandals that have emerged since she came on board and what she's been trying to do for reform?
Yeah, well, I think in fairness, it's best to say that many of the problems that came to light during her tenure over the past 2 years probably predated her. The overtime scandal at Troop E, which, as I said, was the Mass Turnpike, and the payroll discrepancies over at Troop F, which is Logan Airport and the harbor. Still, there were some questionable moves over the past few years, including the hiring of a state trooper who was an unindicted co-conspirator in a marijuana trafficking case. So there's a few things there that have happened on her watch that raised some ire.
There was also a situation where there were payroll records that needed to be part of an investigation that were destroyed under her watch, and they actually would have been relevant to her own investigation. Can you remind us anything about that, Steve?
Yeah, it was back during the gubernatorial election last year. We discovered that there were some paperwork that was filed that would have allowed the state police department to destroy a bunch of records. Basically, under the public records law, if you want to destroy records, you have to make a filing to the Secretary of State's office. That's what they did, kind of, you know, very on the QT. It was discovered that the state police were asking to do that, and the governor put a stop to that.
Steve, in her retirement letter, Colonel Gilpin alluded to some of the scandals. I'll give you just a little bit of it. Quote, "It remains deeply disheartening to me that a small number of our personnel chose to violate our principles and values. We've taken actions to address their transgressions, conducting thorough and painstaking internal investigations as well as criminal investigations," end quote. Seems like she had two priorities when she took over: clean up and restore trust. Those are big goals, and it does seem like they'd take more than 2 years to accomplish. Has she made progress down that path, and is there a lot left to go?
I think she has. As the governor alluded in his remarks, it's a good first step. Another state rep that I was talking to today said that Gilpin made a cultural first step in these past 2 years at the agency. She acknowledged that in her retirement statement, saying that there is still work to be done, but she's confident that it will be accomplished.
We've seen some tweeting on this today, Steve. One of the things that struck me was a tweet from Tom Nolan, a former Boston police lieutenant, who said, "Now it's time for Massachusetts legislature to change the law to allow Mass governor to appoint an outsider to lead this failed rogue agency." Is it really state law that the head of the Massachusetts State Police has to come from inside?
Yes, that's how it works. It has to be that way.
Sorry. Are you hearing any calls to change it?
Well, actually, we heard that alluded to today from the governor in his remarks. He said he's going to be coming forward with a package addressing a lot of things at the state police. One of them probably will be the ability to go outside the agency to find a head. Now the question is, now does he appoint somebody to replace Gilpin as a temporary superintendent, temporary colonel, until the law can change? But it takes a while for laws to change, particularly around here on Beacon Hill.
What are you hearing about a possible replacement, Steve?
There's no one in particular, but there is some talk around here that Gilpin's second in command, Deputy Superintendent Chris Mason, is the odds-on favorite for the job. The governor wasn't going to say anything about that today. We'll have to wait a few days for that announcement.
Anything else that you heard from Governor Baker that's of note?
Again, I think the big thing is that piece of a package of legislation that he alluded to that may be coming down the pike. Again, maybe it's kind of late in the session for that to be coming down the pike. But again, it's something that he wants to do, and we'll see what's in that package.
All right, WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown, I really appreciate it. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Tiziana.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Withman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.